This Israel report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, good morning. How are you?
Boker Tov, we still can't stop talking about the Iranian attack from Saturday night. And one of the little snippets that has come out over the last few days is the fact that one of the Iranian ballistic missiles fell in the Dead Sea. And it's been rescued from the Dead Sea, and it has been put on display to show people exactly what this looks like. It's 11 meters long, and it weighs 450 kilograms. So that was just one example of one of the missiles that fell in Israel, obviously in Israeli space. But as we already know, there was very little damage done, and of course, a miraculous event of Saturday evening. Just another little snippet is news from the Gaza Strip, where a few weeks ago, a bag of flour that had been donated by one of the international humanitarian agencies for Gazans who had been displaced from their homes was apparently selling for 1,800 shekels. Well, yesterday, the same bag of flour was being sold, by the way, the same bag of flour meaning also donated by one of the humanitarian agencies, that was being sold for 95 shekels yesterday.
Unbelievable.
So obviously the Gazan economy is changing. And just one last unrelated war story completely is just a story about Teva, the Israeli pharmaceutical company. And Teva has been named as number 19 among the top 20 earning pharmaceutical companies in the world, finally breaking back into the top 20 after a number of years of being outside of the top 20. And in fact, at one stage, Teva was even in the top 10 of world pharmaceutical companies. Just as a reminder, Teva is the world's largest generic pharmaceutical company, meaning that it produces drugs that are not under patent, and that's really where it's made its mark. Ironically, however, one of Teva's most successful products of all time was Copaxone, which was a drug for multiple sclerosis, which was actually developed at the Weizmann Institute in Rehovot and produced by Teva under patent. That particular patent expired back in 2014, and there was a lot of concern about what that would mean for Teva's revenues. But Teva's managed to peak its revenues in around 2017 at around $22.5 billion. Today, Teva has a revenue line of around $16 billion, back in the top 20, and apparently doing a lot better after also having come through quite a lot of problems during the opioid crisis, where Teva was also the subject of a number of class actions and had to settle on more than a few occasions out of court in order to resolve those. So Teva back on the up and up, and we're happy to see that and hopefully contributing more and more to Israel's economy, which of course, particularly at this time, is really important.
Absolutely. The European foreign ministers visited Israel yesterday. What was the purpose of this visit? What message were they bringing?
Well, we had visits yesterday from both the foreign ministers of the UK and of Germany. And it seems as if, though, the message that the two foreign ministers who met with Israeli foreign minister Israel Katz, the message that they're sending is be careful, be smart. They're not trying to lay down any rules of engagement or not trying to advise Israel what to do. Of course, they do have their own views, and I think that their own views are and don't respond to the Iranian attack. And that was certainly something I think that David Cameron, Lord Cameron from the UK, as well as Annalena Baerbock from Germany, made clear during their meetings yesterday, both with Yisrael Katz and indeed with Prime Minister Netanyahu. But Netanyahu was very, very eager to emphasize to these European foreign ministers who are both visited on the same day, and so therefore one gets a sense that there is certain urgency around diplomatic considerations. But Netanyahu was eager to emphasize to those foreign ministers and indeed other people that he spoke to yesterday that Israel will decide. Israel will make its own decisions about how to respond to what happened on Saturday evening and to respond to Iran in general. And it was quite interesting that a message coming out of the US yesterday was, well, we will agree to you carrying out an operation in Rafah if you don't respond to Iran. Mm. So there's a little bit of playoff going on here about what might be the best of the bad options, potentially, as far as the US looks at things, that they're thinking that potentially an operation in Rafah would be less damaging than a response to Iran. One of the things, by the way, that was so interesting for me on Saturday night when Iran was sending all of these missiles is that Hezbollah, which is, of course, an Iranian proxy, and unashamedly, there's no hiding the fact that it's an Iranian proxy, I would have thought that they would have tried to get involved and open up a front on the north at the same time. But they didn't. And I'm very surprised that they didn't. I would have thought there would have been more coordination, that Hezbollah would have tried to open a front on the north, potentially that whatever's left of Hamas in Gaza would have tried to fire missiles from Gaza at the same time in order to distract Israel and to open up a number of different fronts. And yet that wasn't the case. And I have no explanation as to why that wasn't the case. But I'm sure it'll add to some of the conspiracy theories that are circulating about what Iran intended to do on Saturday evening, or not, as the case may be. But clearly there's a lot of urgency and a certain level of nervousness surrounding what Israel may choose to do. The latest press that I'm seeing suggests that Israel has decided what to do, but has not decided when to do it in terms of a response to Iran, and that it won't be before Pesach. So I don't know whether Israel is trying to use a tactic of, you know, what the Iranians like to do, which says, oh, we will respond in our own time and a place and time of our choosing, and nobody will dictate to us what to do. And in Iran's case, in the most part, those threats have been idle threats, of course, until Saturday evening, because up until now, Iranian responses have been very, very toned down, if anything. I mean, we do know that Iran has, of course, been involved and responsible for many atrocities in the past, including the bombing of Israeli embassies and Jewish centers in Argentina and things like that. Iran has certainly been involved in all of those. But it's not clear that there have been attacks that have been carried out in response, in revenge to some of the things that happened. And for example, the assassination of General Soleimani, who we remember from a few years ago, never ever seemed really to be revenged in the way that Iran had threatened. So all of these things, these threats about at a time and a place of our choosing, seem to be a way of trying to somehow placate the Iranian public to believe that they will ultimately get their revenge, but everybody has to be very patient. And Israel seems to be using that tactic right now to say, oh, we will respond, but it won't be right now immediately. And of course, lots and lots of influence from the international community to try to convince Israel not to respond at all, or if it does respond, to respond in a certain way. All of that remains extremely unclear at the moment as to exactly what will happen next. But clearly, there is this level of uncertainty which is making at least European countries and indeed the United States a little nervous about what the implications could be.
It's absolutely unbelievable to know, to see what is going on. 18 Israelis were injured in this drone attack from the northern border. It's very, very much part of this conversation in terms of Hezbollah and their behavior.
It very much is. And one of the things, by the way, that was noticeable after Saturday evening was that Israel immediately fired against Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. I don't know whether that was considered to be some sort of a response to the Iranian attack on Saturday evening, or whether that was much more local and responding to some of the things that had gone down between Israel and Hezbollah on that northern border. But yesterday, there was certainly a level of the ante being raised a little bit when 18 people were injured in Hezbollah drone attacks. Those drones were fired towards the Bedouin village in the northern Galilee of Arab al-Aramash. And the reports that we see suggest that there was some sort of an attack against a community center in Arab al-Aramash. But what I'm interpreting, without the reports necessarily saying this clearly, is that there might have been an attack against an IDF base in that area, with so many IDF soldiers, 14 IDF soldiers being injured in the process, some of them very, very seriously injured. And this also raises the question about the Hezbollah drones that are being used, how effective they are, how accurate they are, how susceptible they might be to Israel shooting them down. It seems that their drones and their missiles may be becoming increasingly effective. We've had a look at this Ababil model drone, which Hezbollah is using, which is based upon an Iranian Ababil drone. And they seem to have quite a lot of these drones at their disposal. We've already seen something like 150,000 rockets that might be available to Hezbollah, and also up to 2,000 drones. There are also some quite heavy warhead rockets that Hezbollah has, like the Burkan heavy warhead rocket that might be available to it. So these drones, the Ababil drones, are considered to be kind of a kamikaze drone. They include a warhead in the fuselage, and they have an interesting style of two sets of wings, but the wings are not what we would usually expect. Short wings in the front, and then the kind of longer, oddly shaped wings that are more towards the back of the drone. But this drone seems to be incredibly effective and increasingly effective. And I think that the IDF is needing to get a little bit more intelligence on this in order to see what they might be able to do in order to counter these attacks. What I've also understood is that the attack that took place yesterday against this Bedouin village and potentially an IDF base in the area might have been carried out from only 3 kilometers across the border. And therein lies some of the issue, that it doesn't really give the IDF much opportunity to respond in order to take these drones out before they cause damage. So I think there's some work that needs to be done there, because the use of drones has now become a much more integral part of the warfare that we're seeing, not only here, but indeed in Ukraine. We see the use of drones being a very, very effective tool in warfare.
Finally, the mother of a Gaza hostage has been included in the Times list of 100 most influential people for 2024. Who is she?
This is Rachel Goldberg-Polin. She's the mother of Hirsch. He was abducted from the Nova Music Festival on October the 7th. And she has been a very, very visible character on the world stage in terms of promoting the release of hostages from Gaza and making sure that Hirsch and the other hostages stay on the front of the international stage. She is not only an Israeli, but she's also a US citizen coming from California. And of course, her life was turned upside down in the early hours of the morning on October the 7th, when she received two messages from Hirsch. His first message simply said, "I love you." And then his second and final message was, "I'm sorry." And there was some video footage showing that Hirsch actually had one of his arms literally taken off, his hand taken off by some violence that he'd been subject to. And we understand that he had tried to fix some sort of a tourniquet using his shirt onto his arm in order to stop the bleeding after losing his hand. And that's kind of what we know about Hirsch Goldberg Polin when he was taken into Gaza along with 240 other hostages. He's 23 years old. And of course, like his mother and his father, he is an American citizen as well as an Israeli citizen. And Rachel has been very, very visible promoting the plight of Gaza hostages on the international stage to the point. She's had an audience with the Pope, and she's been to the United Nations, and she's been to New York City and Geneva, and she's really done a lot of international work in order to promote this issue to the point when Time magazine has recognized her as one of the world's most 100 most influential people for this year, which I think is an astonishing achievement and yet a very sad one at the same time. Mm.
Absolutely. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. We will catch you on Monday morning. So we look forward to speaking to you on Monday morning at the same time, wishing you a fantastic weekend and a Shabbat Shalom.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands.
Hi, it's Barry Cohen from the Blue Agency. Israel is currently facing one of its biggest challenges ever. All of Klal Yisrael is praying for the safety of our soldiers and the return of the hostages. We hope and pray that our soldiers and security forces will prevail and that they will all return home speedily and triumphant. We hold the hands of our clients and friends who have children serving in Tzahal, who are protecting Israel and Jews around the world. May Hashem protect us all. Bye.